This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
What you're about to hear is an unscripted, one-time counseling session focused on work. For the purposes of maintaining confidentiality, names, employers, and other identifiable characteristics have been removed, but their voices and their stories are real.
I gotta be honest, I chose this job because there was really nothing for me to do, and I just thought if I can go to the school, it's 9 months long, I like to look pretty, I'll be able to wear whatever I want, but I don't want to get close with all these random people. It stresses me out.
While hairdressers may come armed with a pair of scissors or a blow dryer, their real talent lies in how they manage their relationship with the clients. What they do is way beyond cuts and color. In fact, the business they're really in is the business of people. I read a line by a celebrity stylist named Nick Arojo. It said something like this: as shears snip perilously close to the face, as a new shape and style reveals itself, and as one begins to feel more beautiful, an uncommonly close friendship emerges, often for a lifetime. And how this relationship materializes is something of a curiosity. Like a bar stool or a psychiatrist's couch, the hairdresser's chair prompts people to pour out their hearts.
I feel continually undermined.
The job has always been that place where I've been needed and I feel important.
A lot of the people that work for me are like an extension of my family.
There's no doubt that your emotional and relational dowry comes with you to work.
Imagine going to work every day in a really busy place and no one will make eye contact with you.
I mean, it feels like a breakup.
It doesn't feel. It is. So, how's work? How many years are you in the business?
Oh gosh, 21.
And you?
14.
Okay, so we're not talking about beginners here, right?
Old dog.
No, experienced women.
Most of my career, I'm just trying to figure out a way to like get away from it.
Yeah, she's always trying to do a different career.
Yeah.
She's like, not really a hairdresser. That's what she always said.
I just want stability and consistency in my life. And, you know, I mean, that's the job. There's a lot of things I want to do in life, but really on paper, that's what I can do to make money, you know? So now, yeah, I have my first full-time job in 6 years.
Okay. And how is it going so far?
I mean, it's going fine, but I've had a lot of fear of people.
Which people?
My bosses and coworkers. If I'm not, like, one of the things with our industry is that, that's different than a lot of jobs is it's sales, basically. And if you're not busy, there's no, like, office to go in and shut the door. And you're just, like, out in a room with people. So for me, like, when I haven't been busy, the financial insecurity is triggered. And then also, like, thinking I'm not good enough. So I've just been...
How many minutes of not busy do you have to be?
Sometimes it could be hours at a time.
But how many minutes before you triggered?
It's more like when I have to sit around for anything more than an hour, I start to panic.
When you panic, what happens?
I start thinking everyone's against me and they don't think that my work is good enough and that I'm actually not busy because they don't want to give me clients. Then I go and ruminate down everything wrong I've done in my career to be in this situation. And then, I mean, because I'm in recovery 12-step, I now I go out and I like call someone from the program and try to reset, because once I start having all those thoughts about why I'm not busy and what's going to happen in my life and everything's going to fall to pieces, if I'm not like using the tools of recovery and like cognitive behavioral tools, I will start trying to control the situation, and it has never worked in my favor. It's manipulation as well. Lots of manipulation.
As in trying to endear yourself?
That, and trying to get on the manager's
favorite list.
Favorite list,
yes,
of course.
Yes, that's endearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And try to, like, get them to give me more people, or even to throw other people under the bus so I'll get more people.
So when you get in a panic, in the past, you'd try to get other people to get you out of the panic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Primarily by endearing yourself and telling them how miserable you feel, and please help me and make me feel better at any cost. And today, you're able to tackle your own negative self-talk, reach out, but not as save me, but as help me help myself. Yeah?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I'm feeling good about it that I've used those tools, but I wish I didn't have to deal with the feelings of all this. It's like very painful for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And daily sometimes.
Last week, it was like every day, like starting around, I think it was like Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then the Friday, it was so bad. I felt like I was going to have a panic attack. Because ultimately...
Is she one of the people you reach out to?
Yeah, she's one of my biggest, been one of the most supportive people in my life, you know, ever. And she knows like what I'm talking about. So there's that, you know.
As I listen to her talk about how insecure she feels, how if she's not instantly busy, it becomes a marker of her self-worth, about her anxiety and her panic, about her sense that she's being judged and evaluated on a constant basis, and how she evaluates herself on a constant basis. From there to asking about her family is just a millimeter away. What's the echo chamber between your family history and your fears at work? Sometimes I think that our relationship with our siblings is also a predecessor to our relationship with our coworkers.
Well, yeah, because like my brother got all the attention compared to me. My parents, he just had more in common with them. So yeah, I think what I realized at my job about a week in is that no matter where I go, I'm always trying to make sure that I am going to get taken care of. And I think that someone else is going to get more, like, security than me because my brother did. It's a new awareness. Like, they would just ignore me while I played with my toys, but then they would be, like, doing T-ball and all that stuff with him, and they always would be like, why can't you just be more like your brother? He knows when to shut his mouth. I mean, my mom told me, ever since you were born, you were a problem. You came out screaming and crying, and you drove me crazy, and your brother was an angel.
What an amazing welcoming ceremony.
So I've been hearing that, like, my whole life.
I'm being facetious, but this is, you're saying it with half a smile, but...
I'm just so used to it. So I think at work, like, if I see someone else get another appointment than me, I'm like, of course, nobody fucking cares about me, and they're only going to care about this person.
Sometimes we get our most powerful resources from our family as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even from painful experiences in our families. She's immediately honest, and she's able to connect the dots. And she sees that she has been competing with her brother all along, and now she's competing with her coworkers, and that there's an eerie resemblance between the relationship we have sometimes with our siblings and with our coworkers. Anywhere she goes, she immediately makes sure that she's being noticed. But the strategies that we develop in our childhood in order to adapt and to survive sometimes become worn out. And so what I'm also noticing is that she's constantly living as if she's in survival mode, even when there is really no need for it. And it is probably one of the most important tasks when we become adults, is to realize which one of our adaptation skills is still important and useful, and which ones have actually become very counterproductive. And so I want to bring both of them into this conversation now. What are some of the resources that they have? They wouldn't be successful otherwise. There's something from their experience as a child that they use in the way that they connect with their clients.
What would you say are some of the significant resources that you draw? I'm going to make it more specific even. The significant resources that you bring to work and that you know find their roots in your family history?
Just the kind of the tenacity, like the stick-to-itiveness. I think both my, you know, it's funny. I don't often think of the things they've done.
You
well.
Never think of it in a positive term, you
yeah.
see, because you think of the legacy in the way that it
right.
hurt you. But it's more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fractal, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the strengths that you have come often from the same place as the troubles that you have.
Yeah. You know, while you guys were talking, I thought, you know, my father as
you
a kid...
You listened so beautifully and you thought about a lot of things at the same time. I saw.
Yeah, thank you. I think my, you know, as a child, my father didn't pay a lot of attention to me because he was working so much. And then when he would come home, he loved to go into the basement. He was a Grateful Dead head. He loved his music. That's like where he went. So his presence wasn't that there in my life, whereas my mother was like kind of all over me in a lot of ways. But I remember when I just started in our industry and I was 21 and I got this celebrity hair salon job as an assistant. And I remember coming home with like a pile of tips, like in the envelopes, and like dumping them on the kitchen table. And like he lit up, like it was like he was paying attention to me. Something about me actually ignited his attention, which I was not used to.
And your experience of it was?
I mean, I just wanted more of that, which I think has, you know, contributed to the drive I have, but my drive has been also like a detriment at times.
Does it create, do you feel that you are continuously in a competitive environment or that there is also solidarity?
I think the place I'm at now is the best of the places I've been. And it's interesting because it's almost like the top level of talent that I've worked with. I think a lot of that has to do with me because a lot of it is in my own mind.
Mm.
Like a lot of it is me. I'm the one setting the competition. You know, when you come into work, everybody's looking at everybody's like schedules to see how many clients you have. It's just like it's just a thing that you do. And if I have a lot of clients, my worth is up here. And if I don't have a lot of clients that day, I go into the toilet. And so
what can the job do to make to alleviate that? When you say it's the best place I've been at, what?
I mean, I think the owner of the place I work sets the tone too. So she's super successful, you know, very celebrated hair colorist, but she's humble. And so the younger generation there kind of models her, like after her. So there just isn't a whole lot of ego. Whereas when I came into the business in the 90s, I mean, it was so full of ego and everybody's, you know, it was very cutthroat. So I think a lot of it has to do with the leader. Like, I think that sets the tone. And then the other really positive thing is that people ask for help at this place, which I've never seen in any other place. Like, if I had a question about hair color, you would just never.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whereas here, it's more of a team effort. And so you have, like, you know, I mean, I know for me, I want to know what the kids are doing, because that's what keeps it fresh and alive.
Mm-hmm. Does that change your inner state? Or is your inner state active on its own?
On its own.
Irrespective of the environment in which you're in?
I think now my inner state has improved enough to where I'm matching my environment. I feel like a lot of the time the places I worked were a reflection of my inner state. So some of the worst times in my life, it was like I would inevitably be working for somebody who would abuse me to the extent that I was abusive or critical of myself. And then I worked in other...
Explain this to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess I would say again, like when I was in like the throes of my addiction and, you know, eating disorder, like very self-destructive, my first job was assisting this colorist who would just like shame and humiliate me and criticize me and, you know, nothing was good enough and you'll never be a colorist and, you know, women will never be as successful. It was just like every harsh and mean thing that you could say, you know, body shame my outfits, like everything, like he would just tear me to pieces. But looking back, that was really a match to what was going on with me. Like that's definitely was my own inner dialogue. He would say all the things I already believed to be true about myself. It was just, you know, reflected in his treatment of
me. You feel the pain while she talks, right?
I just don't.
It's like she's lacerating.
Yeah, well, I'm just so sick of, like, that, like, attraction.
Yeah.
Like, I just, because right now I'm working so hard on, like, really having high self-worth. And
say
I think,
to him.
Yeah, and yeah. I think it's, like, the best it's been. But I'm just, like, so I get, like, really afraid with the law of attraction stuff that if I think, like, something, you know, negative, that it's going to, like, happen on the outside, you know? But I guess, like, I don't want, like, you know, bad stuff to happen because I'm feeling that on the inside. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I totally get that.
But I didn't make a lot last week. I think that's crazy.
Well, you're practicing. Mm-hmm. You're practicing mm-hmm. that if you have a week where you have less income, that doesn't necessarily translate instantly into you're a lesser person.
Because that's what it is for me a lot. It's like, if I've got money like coming
but
in...
Let me stop you 1 second.
Uh-huh.
Because I just noticed something here. You were talking and you were reacting to what she was saying, so I just wanted you to voice it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you began talking about you again.
Mm-hmm.
And you're used to that.
Used to what?
To having someone take over and say, you think you have it bad, let me tell you mine.
Oh.
And you just retreated.
I didn't notice.
But now you do?
It's hard because I have like a mentoring type
yes.
of relationship with her.
Yes, but I'm going to something different.
Yeah.
Because she literally took it back and took it over to her. And you receded.
Hmm.
Is that familiar to you?
I mean, I would say so. Actually, in the workplace, I could see where that type of thing happens. And it makes me think of like this hindrance that in my career I've had with like being seen or being visible in spite of having a lot of like talent and skill at what I do. Where I grew up, when I got attention, and I did when I was like a teenager and people started to notice me, and I actually was physically attacked for that, for like the things that were positive about me,
mm-hmm.
even though it's a little different than what we're talking about. But it's just something where I will shut it down. I'll dim down.
And what about home sets you up for this receding?
because at home.
You recede. See, you do two things at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you recede, and then on the other hand, you watch to see who gets more.
Mm, that's true. That's definitely true. Who at home? I think probably like my father, I would recede more because I was afraid of him, his disapproval, because I got so little from him to begin with. So I think any more disapproval from him or any sense of disappointing him, I think I would, you know, I would, that would dim me down.
Do you think that it changes the way you work with a female boss or a male boss?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an interesting question. This is actually part of the theme and why this is all very interesting to me. Like, with authority figures, how I do turn them into parents. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, with men, sometimes I feel like it's like a sexualized piece where I turn myself into an object. And then I feel like with sometimes male bosses, I feel like I have to kind of use that angle. Even though I don't do anything, I just feel like I put that foot forward a little.
Explain to me. That foot can mean a lot of things look a lot of ways.
I think just being coy or even acting childlike sometimes. Like if I need to get my need met, I can be like a little girl, and then they think I'm cute, and then they, you know. And it's not, it's kind of a newer observation.
Yours is a cute little girl, and yours is the damsel in distress.
100%.
Yeah.
I always have to be, like, needing help.
Very early into this conversation, it becomes clear to me that these are two seasoned professional hairstylist women who, while they talk about their fears, their insecurities, and their challenges with their sense of self-worth, they are also talking about their competitiveness, their singular-mindedness, and the way that they each try the age-old seduction tactics that women have engaged with forever when seeking power, recognition, affirmation, and attention. So these strategies are primarily with men bosses.
The needing the help, I only do that with guys.
And the coy, cute, little girl daddy, help me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or just like, you know, just using look, like appearance. Mm-hmm. To get approval or
attention.
Yeah.
And with women bosses, what's the strategy?
Avoid.
I've either had like
avoid at all costs.
Like defiant teenager. I've had that one at a couple of jobs. Because ultimately, I'm afraid of authority figures. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like threatened, even when there is no threat. I sense a threat. Like rejection, abandonment, or humiliation, or just being shamed. Because I think with my, at least particularly with my mother, and I actually know you can relate to this, like having somebody who really gives you a lot of like adoration and, oh, you're so amazing and you're this and you're that. And then like it switches. And then it's like, you're a piece of shit and you're a fucking, you know, failure. And how come you're not as good as this one? And how come this one gets 100 and you didn't get and you got a 95? Like, so, and I feel like I've had employers like that, you know, over, not anymore, because I think I've done enough interior work on myself that that's not my experience anymore. But for years, that was my experience with like bosses saying even very similar things that my own mother would say.
And the growing up was about finding different bosses or putting limits?
Mm. Oh, I always found a new boss.
Have you learned to put limits?
I'm learning. It's a great question. It's been really hard because I've instead more like, how do I exit the situation? Or I just get so, outraged about the situation, similar to how I felt with my mother, that yeah, I just leave.
And the voice of outrage says what?
The voice of the outrage?
Yeah.
Fuck you for not valuing me, for not seeing me, for not supporting me. And now you have to deal with the consequences of that. Like, of my leaving.
But with a client, how do you do it? Because I assume sometimes you have clients. We haven't talked about the clients.
Oh, God. Either, right? It's totally different with a client.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud. Or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Who do you become with the client?
The
basically, you're telling me there is me with the boss, me with the coworkers, and me with the client.
Yeah, and it's all very different. And with the client, I'm like the overgiver, people pleaser beyond. Like, and I'm in a job that it kind of is about pleasing people to an extent, but over nurturing, like over. Just overgiving, but it's all out of fear of like abandonment or rejection and humiliation again.
So you give while you resent the fact that you've given so much power to them. You enjoy the giving, or you feel like I'm giving just as a deterrent strategy.
I think it feels.
I give so I don't have to feel afraid that.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Yeah, it's like just it's definitely. Very fear-based, that I'll lose them, you know.
Even though it's notorious that people are loyal to their stylists and their colorists more than many, many other businesses.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I have so many clients for like...
A lifetime.
Yeah, yes. A lifetime. But I can't see that. Like, I'll focus on the 1 out of 10 that wasn't happy that day, and I'll obsess and I'll ruminate and... like there was an experience I had 7 years ago where I had made a move. I moved salons and I had like 5 of my clients reacted really strongly. Like, I hate it here. Why did you come here? Like such a, you know, so like strong. And these were like the clients who were like my mom's age, they were like moms to me, you know, or I made them that way. Like, I just never expected that switch. And I went into such like a panic, like that was so disproportionate to the situation.
What is the trauma legacy of this?
I mean, I just think with my, mostly with my mother, like emotionally and psychologically, you know, she was not, she was very unstable that way. And like she, it would be very loving one moment and then another would just be totally like cutting me down and hysteria and panic. She was very like, you know, undisciplined emotionally. So seeing somebody in that state just brings up such a sense of fear, but also a responsibility that it's my fault, but that it's also my job to fix it. And I definitely have brought that into my work with clients, where like their emotional upset suddenly becomes my responsibility and it's too big for me. And I never, like, it's like walking on eggshells, like, am I good right now or am I not good right now?
And I'm never really sure that what I do is right. going to change their mood.
Right.
Even though I have to. But their mood has just switched.
Yes.
And flipped, irrespective of what I do.
Yes. You know, we all have coworkers who are like, who cares? That bitch is crazy. Mm-hmm. Who cares? And I'm like, no sleep for a weekend. Total mm-hmm. obsession.
And have you learned the tools? Have you learned some tools
yes.
to regulate yourself,
yes.
to literally to deal, first of all, with the body, because
yeah.
your body is holding it,
oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So many. Yeah, like a lot of breathing. Mm-hmm. I
And you can do it in the moment?
I can now do it in the moment. It's relatively new that I can regulate myself,
mm-hmm.
You know, somewhat. I still have room to grow there, but... I don't go that low anymore.
So
you know,
you do sleep during the weekend.
Now I sleep. I do not lose sleep over a client for the most part. There and actually there was a client who it wasn't really because of something I did, but I referred her to get a haircut because I do color, and I referred her to get a haircut, and she wasn't happy with the cut, and she like freaked out and like put her hands on me, and she's like, I thought you said it was going to be here, meaning, like, collar, but she, like, touched me, and it, like, really, I froze, which is, like, the first response, and then I had, like, a couple of bad days, but then I bounced back, whereas I think something like that in the past, also because she did it in front of people, that scenario of being publicly humiliated would have, you know, but there was a something more solid in me where I realized that, like, oh, this has nothing to do with me. Like, I just
Beautiful.
Didn't take any of it on.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So that was definitely a success.
That's when you know
yeah.
things are changing.
Things are changing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, breathing, meditating, yoga. Just, I try to do a bunch of things like that to, you know, therapy.
Here you did more than that. Here you simply also said, this is not home.
Yeah.
I'm not a child with mm-hmm. mom. This is a client who is not happy with her cut.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not responsible.
Mm-hmm.
I can care, but I am not responsible.
Right.
I mean, you stayed in the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
It's more that. When you're triggered, you're not just remembering, you're reliving.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I was right? definitely more
Once you,
in my body right. in that
this,
moment.
You were not, when you froze, you were reliving.
Yeah.
But once you were able to breathe yourself out of it, you were mm-hmm. in the here and now. You were
mm-hmm.
not
right.
the 8-year-old.
Right.
How old is she?
Who, the...
The girl?
The girl.
The girl that freezes.
I think, like, yeah, I always think of her around, like, between 10 and 12, because that's when I first started displaying, like, OCD, behaviors to control my sense of chaos.
A child that grows up with a parent who goes back and forth between loving and aggressive and violent, between hugging and slapping, is a child who, as she describes, becomes sometimes intensely responsible for thinking that they created the inner state of the other parent or that it's their responsibility to change their mood. And they experience a sense of dread about it and an uber sense of responsibility for it. She experiences that with her clients. As we discuss the need to establish a boundary, to put a limit. The limit is not in saying to the other person, don't talk to me this way. The limit is also to understand where the other one stops and where she starts so that she can be kind or respectful or firm or decisive without feeling that the life of the other is her own, basically, or the inner life of the other is her own. And she's doing that by learning all kinds of strategies for self-regulation through breathing, through yoga, through meditation. But these strategies give her the space that is needed to then establish the boundary that is really the determining factor. The boundary that says, this is where I stop and this is where you start. And therefore, if you were upset about your haircut, that doesn't make me stay awake for the whole week. Are most of your clients women?
Yes.
And do you ever see a kind of an irony that you went into a place, finish the sentence?
Well, yeah. Oh, gosh. With so many...
It's a practice that is the continuation of your childhood.
Yeah.
Right? Pleasing women.
Pleasing women. Who are sometimes emotionally, you know... just erratic, I guess.
But you don't just please them. They also let you get close to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're one of the few professions that people can still touch someone.
Oh, yeah.
And not have to fear instant repercussions.
Right.
So you get to have a closeness, mm-hmm. a physical closeness.
Mm-hmm.
You get to touch.
Mm-hmm.
You get to put your hand in their hair, which is one of the most... early experiences any baby ever has, universally. You get to wash their hair, which is one of our most primary experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very intimate, it's very physical, it's very proximate. So you get to come close to the women. You're not just busy pleasing them.
Right.
You also get to have a closeness you never had.
Right. Yeah, and that's the part I do love.
That's the part I hate. Too much responsibility.
Meaning?
I don't know. Like, when you were saying all that stuff to her, I don't like touching these people, really, and dealing with all their bullshit. If they're nice, then it's, like, a lot better, you know? And they mostly are, but I got to be honest, like, I chose this job because I was, like, really out of control, and I was so young, and there was really nothing for me to do, and I just thought, if I can go to the school, it's 9 months long, I like to look pretty, I'll be able to wear whatever I want, it was, you know, but... Yeah, like, it's so stressful for me dealing with these people. Just hearing you talk about that, I was like, oh, my God, I don't want to go to work after this. Like, you know, I'm so serious. Like, and then the guys, since I cut hair, like, I deal with the men, you know? I like having relationships with people, but I don't like, multiple hours of my day. I'm, like, on the judgment block. At something like this, I'm just taking orders from people all day. I don't want this piece like this. Like, move it right here. Like, it's just so... I get, like, angry even thinking about it. Like, I used to want to be famous, career, all that stuff. And now it's like, I just want to, like, meet the right guy and get a cute dog and maybe move out of the city. You know? But I guess, like, I don't trust that it will happen or something. Like,
can I say something?
Yeah.
I think...
More than something.
Like, because I know you well. I know it's, like, a defense. Mm-hmm. And that I see that that's the stories. Well, I hate these clients anyway. And I don't really want to do this anyway. It, you know, as a way to, like, avoid.
Can someone... not like something without it meaning you're not good enough?
I'm just afraid of getting, like, fired.
No, you're afraid of being homeless.
Yeah.
Not just fired. You're afraid of being destitute. You're afraid of remaining nothing.
Yeah, it's a complete descent. It's not just I got a client and they didn't like the cut.
It's like so
it becomes they didn't like the cut and I'm not good enough and I'm not good enough and I'm going to be fired and I'm going to be fired and I'm going to be penniless and I'm going to be penniless and I'm going to be homeless.
Yeah.
And the only defense against it is to say, I don't like these people. Mm-hmm. Because if I don't like them, then I diminish the power that they have over their ability to destroy me. Mm. And in an interesting way, it's like you're not in relationship with them. It's everything that they can do to you. It's not a mutual relationship. You actually rarely think about them. You only think about what they do to your sense of self. Mm-hmm. How they can elevate you or crush you. Mm-hmm. And how you resent the power that they have over you, which of course you hand them all in your head. Mm. But there is very little, there's no other person. When you talk about them, they're not real people. They're all stand-ins for your family. But
no.
They're not real people. You know?
Make it stop, please.
Do you understand what I'm saying? They're not real people. I have no sense of these people as human beings,
right.
Who they are, what they had this morning, why they came to get a haircut because they just lost somebody, or because they just got fired, or because they just realized that their partner had been cheating on them, or because whatever. There's no sense that these other people have an inner life. The only one with an inner life is you. They're like stand-ins of trigger points. Mm-hmm. They're like acupressures, mm-hmm. but in the negative sense.
But how do I'm so afraid of something bad happening to me. Like I am.
And what
like
I'm suggesting
terrified.
To you is that you may be less afraid if you actually made these people more three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. If you began to see them as people. With an inner life, with a psychology, with a complexity, with circumstances, with a story. Otherwise, they are just triggers for your story. Mm-hmm. If you humanize them, they would shrink to size. They wouldn't all be these ominous, demonic powers. Imagine you go today. And when somebody sits down and they're new, you approach them with curiosity. I come to you. Mm-hmm. We've never met. I have no idea where you are. Doesn't matter. And I just say, somebody recommended, because that's probably how I got to you. I'm no less scared than you are. But when you meet me, you think only you are scared. Mm-hmm. You don't have a clue that I may be worried, or that I'm nervous, or that I once had a bad experience, or that I have so much hope because I don't feel good about me that you would make me feel better about me because you're going to beautify me. I mean, I too come with the whole story to you. Mm-hmm. And you say, we are new to each other. What's it like for you when you meet a new hairdresser or stylist? You ask that question to the person. That's a curiosity question. What have been some of the cuts you've really liked? Do you want to guide me? Do you want me to, you know, do you have any idea of what you want? You know, in a way, the 2-minute conversation between what do you want? Do you know? Can you express what you want? Can you articulate it? It is one of the most beautiful rituals of consent. Mm-hmm. In 2 minutes, we are establishing an entire contract. Between strangers at that moment.
Where it really goes wrong for me is like, I think that people like aren't gonna like it.
And I'm like, suggesting something to you. Listen to me carefully. Mm-hmm. Because you're talking about you. Mm-hmm. And I am trying to move the needle over to them. Mm-hmm. To really be curious about them, not to project on them. They don't exist in real terms, these people. They just exist as figments of your frightening imagination. I want you to be actually curious about the person sitting and giving herself over to your magical hands. Mm-hmm. And I want you to think about that person
not about what she's going to do to you, if she's going to affirm you or destroy you, but about who she or he is at the level that is necessary. It's curiosity that will ground you in reality.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine this? Yes, take a deep breath.
I feel so much anxiety from thinking about all this. I have like a headache.
Then stay with the breath for a moment.
Yeah.
Just stay with the breath. Don't talk.
Okay.
Don't talk. I just said a lot that to take in. And sometimes the minute you put your hands in their hair, they start talking. They confide in you. You know, I always think it's either this couch, the bar stool, or the hairstylist chair. That's where the stories get told.
But what about the people that just, like, aren't nice? Like, can we... Because there's a lot of them, and they sit down, and the first thing they say is, how long is this going to take? Because I need to leave in, like, 25 minutes. And it's already something that would be ridiculous to think that it would take that long. Because it would be longer, 45. And then as soon as you start working, they tell you they don't like that. And then they say, where did you work before this? And they literally want to make you feel bad. It's not every day necessarily, but, you know.
It's helped me to see that when there is a difficult client, it's not a unique experience personal to me,
mm-hmm.
that it happens to everybody. So I, including like my boss, who again is like a, you know, world renowned, you know, person in the industry, and to see that she has unhappy clients too. And this one has a redo too. And this one has this, you know, and it doesn't break them. And it just takes it off of me as like, oh, this thing that's happening to me because I suck because I'm not good enough and all this pressure.
Beautiful.
You know, that has helped me navigate a difficult client because inevitably everybody has one.
Mm-hmm. And Is that useful?
Yeah, it's useful. And I mean, I know logically and from experience, the more calm you are and just like easygoing, then you kind of can like diffuse it, you know? If you're defensive, it just makes it worse.
Interestingly, though, we talked about clients and you went directly to the, but what about the mean ones?
Mm-hmm.
They're not the majority.
No.
But that's the one, but they're the ones you want to hone in on.
I'm just...
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to help you with them, by the way. But it's like... part of what will change your experience of the world is that you resist going to those as the first ones and as the only ones that matter, like mm-hmm. the one in 10 that you just spoke about right. before.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know? Can you imagine that the one that sits in the chair and says, I only have 20 minutes... isn't only being mean, but may be in the midst of a big problem themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And curiosity would say, are you having a tough day?
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Huh?
It's so true. That's when I was able to make that switch off of myself and onto them, it totally alleviated a lot of that pressure. Like, oh, you know. Oh, where are you going? You have to be, what time do you have to be out? Like when they're all like, I gotta get out of here. Oh, what do you have going on? Just lighten it. I just try to lighten it, realizing that they're anxious. How can I alleviate their anxiety? This way it's about them and not me.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Well said. Very well said.
Yeah, it helps, definitely.
Esther Perel is a best-selling author, speaker, and host of the podcast, Where Should We Begin? To learn more about Esther Perel's world, to sign up for her newsletter, or to apply to be on the podcast, go to estherperel.com/howswork. How's Work is produced by Magnificent Noise for Gimlet and Esther Perel Productions. Our production staff includes Eric Newsom, Eva Wolchover, Destry Sibley, Alex Lewis, Kristen Muller, and our coordinating producer is Lindsay Rutowski. Our recording engineer is Noriko Okabe, and Damon Whittemore is our mix engineer. The theme song was written by Doug Slaywin, and the executive producers of How's Work are Esther Perel and Jesse Baker. We would also like to thank Nazanin Rafsanjani, Matt Lieber, Darian LaBeach, Courtney Hamilton, Kelly Rose, Nick Oxenhorn, Dr. Guy Winch, Paul Schneider, Thomas Curry, Shani Avaram, and Jack Saul.